The American population, you might have heard, is in the midst of a major shift. Demographers predict that by the 2040s, white people will be a minority relative to all other ethnic groups. We're already different. Children come to school with far more diverse cultural backgrounds and even languages than a generation ago. Our guest this hour addresses how to teach those children. Zaretta Hammond speaks today at 4:30 at Southern Oregon University's Stevenson Union, part of the university's campus theme for the academic year, which is From Ignorance to Wisdom. Zaretta Hammond is a national education consultant and author of Culturally Responsive Teaching and The Brain, Promoting Authentic Engagement and Rigor for Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Students. Zaretta is a former high school and community college expository writing instructor. She blogs at crtandthebrain.com. Zaretta Hammond, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
My brain wants to call this culturally responsible education. Is it that too?
I think you can think about the responsibility we have to make sure all children are educated well. And one of the things we know is Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings talks about this as the education debt. So we know numbers of children in urban settings and rural settings, immigrant students for whom English is not their first language, have in many cases been undereducated, and that has been by design, not by happenstance, not because we're just now becoming more diverse, but because our country was predicated on racial stratification, and part of that social reproduction happened in our school systems. So the idea of making sure that we're responsible now for paying that education debt, I think, is part of the larger umbrella that this sits in.
When you say it was by design, in other words, it was like, you know, we don't want to have good schools for the minority people?
Absolutely. So if you go back and look at what Thomas Jefferson said, and this is, you know, in our writings of our founding fathers, they talked about a two-tiered system in which some will be undereducated and those of the ruling class, landowners, will be educated to the highest levels. I know it's a little shocking because we don't highlight that part of our history. And part of the process for doing that was to underdevelop the diverse students and diverse communities' ability to do information processing, do higher order thinking. This is why we had illiteracy laws, laws against teaching reading to enslaved Africans, to First Nation peoples. It's kind of there for those that want to see it. Absolutely.
Yeah, especially the not teaching people part. That really stings from our history. And so it sounds like we have to break away from this idea that things are going to be stratified. We actually can, if we put our minds to it, get to a place where everybody knows the things they need to know.
I hope we can.
So was there anything like CRT when you began teaching? Did it supplant something else?
This has actually been around for a long time. Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings, Geneva Gay, Dr. Asa Hilliard, these are some of the prominent names probably 30, 35 years ago that in many ways coined the term and kind of curated and codified what had been around for a long time. The problem was that this was not the mainstream. It had been okay to undereducate Black and brown children. And so now what we're seeing is we need all hands on deck, or more appropriately, all minds in gear to solve some of our larger, you know, national problems, but also global problems. You know, the cure of cancer might be one of those urban low-income kids. And who knows that? So we don't have the luxury in this country of educating anyone. And, you know, as the old saying goes, the mind is a terrible thing to waste.
Truly. You come from San Francisco. Your parents did not put you in your neighborhood school there, but they put you across town in a mostly white school. And I love the story in your book about figuring out from coming back home to the neighborhood and hanging out on the playgrounds that things were very different in the school you would have been in otherwise.
This was my own awareness, but that practice has been going on since the years of Jim Crow. The idea that people of color know that schools are separate and unequal and have been, and therefore parents will do, you know, whatever they can to make sure children get access to high-level instruction. And so that, in my case, meant my mother used my grandparents' address to send us to that neighborhood school. And I was able to see, going back to the projects where I lived, my mother was a single parent, and we lived in the projects in Hunter's Point. But I started to see that this two-tiered system of education was in full effect. A lot of times what we see now are educators that blame families. You know, oh, those families don't care, or those kids aren't motivated. When those parents came through the same systems, and so they have the same legacy of undereducation, miseducation, underdevelopment of literacy, poor writing skills, not because of their own lack of initiative. Education has always been the path out of poverty and road toward equality. So there's a way in which majority educators have a tendency to forget that.
Yeah, you place a huge connection between literacy and equity in our country.
Absolutely. Right. One of the things we know from cognitive neuroscience is learning to read grows your brain, right? Just the process.
Being read too in early years, right?
Well, yeah. But the reality is, regardless of whether you're read to, whether you encounter language orally, your brain is going to grow. But we know for the kind of learning that we need in schools, that learning to read, because learning to read is not a natural thing for the brain to do. It is something that has to be taught. It will not just happen because you put a book in front of a child. So, oh, they should have books at home, we hear all the time. Well, that's not enough. So the reality is we recognize, and those founding fathers knew this as well, that the more that you learn to read, that reading grows dendrites. Those dendrites turn into neural pathways. You start to not only be a code breaker, I can read the words on the page, but a text critic. I can now engage the ideas on the page. Now, you know, you don't want people thinking if you're trying to marginalize or oppress them. So this is why we started America with those illiteracy laws. But now we know it's also the path to equity.
Back with more with Zaretta Hammett and culturally responsive teaching on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, we're talking to Zaretta Hammond about culturally responsive teaching, something she teaches to educators across the country. She's written a book about it, too. She'll be talking about it this afternoon at the Southern Oregon University campus at the Rogue River Room in the Stevenson Union, part of the campus theme From Ignorance to Wisdom. The event is free and open to the public, and we're glad to have Zaretta Hammond here. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about literacy and equity and how the ability to decode the text and then begin to absorb the ideas from the text, huge in the development of a brain. You acknowledged already the constant complaint, let's say, from people who say, well, they just don't value education in the home. How does an educator then compensate for what they perceive to be a lack of literacy in the home or a lack of emphasis on literacy in the home?
Well, they actually teach children to read because that's our job as educators. So the reality is parents don't teach children how long vowels work. Teachers do. So if the child is in your care, you cannot move them to the next grade if they've not gotten that content, if they're not automatic with their ability to decode, because the reality is they can't comprehend text if they can't do that. So we're not trying to compensate for what's going on at home. Parents are children's first teachers. They're doing a fine job, and we let them do what they do. Now, are we in partnership with them? Yes. But teachers aren't doing backup to what parents are teaching at home. Our job in our school systems are to teach children to read, to write, to computate, to do that at not only basic levels, but higher levels as well. That's really our moral and our economic charge as school districts.
You mentioned in your book that we want to get to independent thinkers. What we have is a lot of dependent learners, though. I mean, dependent upon who or what?
Well, they're dependent in the sense that they depend on the teacher to carry more of the cognitive load during instruction. So teachers are actually, and within our school system, and it's part of inequity by design, we're actually breeding dependent learners. So rather than not teaching children to read, we're under-teaching them. We're under-developing that. So what you see in a lot of school districts, let's just take reading scores, for example. Year in, year out, the same children are at the bottom, the same children at the top, usually along economic or racial lines, in terms of reading scores. But the reality is we're not making sure that those children are reading proficient. If they are, then we don't make sure they have word wealth, meaning their vocabulary and academic conversation may be low. So that there are things that we know we should focus on that are kind of at the epicenter of equity in order to make sure that the children actually can carry more of that thinking load during instruction. But when we over-scaffold, when we spoon-feed them, when we focus on worksheets over robust conversation and teaching them how to have kind of academic conversations, then in many ways we're underdeveloping it. So the analogy I like to use, it's like picking up a child who's 11 months old, looks like they want to start walking, but every time you see them possibly, you know, teeter around, you go and pick them up and say, I'll carry you. And you carry them around for the next 5 years. Well, when you put them down again, their legs are going to be weakened. So dependent learners are the idea that we're not building the cognitive resources and capacity and muscle, right? The learning muscles, so kids can do the higher order work we want them to do. So, I would say that we're making them dependent on the teacher to do more of that processing so that when they're now sitting with the test alone, they can't read the text because they are not good readers. They don't do the kind of thinking that requires them to figure things out because the teacher is doing too much of that. So I liken it to kind of getting ready for a marathon. You don't just sign up for the marathon and go sit on your couch. You actually have to do the cognitive, the physical work to kind of get you ready. Start with a mile, then you go to five, and your coach is going to push you. The teacher is the coach of students' cognitive development. And what we see is in certain schools, certain communities, based on income, maybe, you know, language or race, that level of rigor is not going on.
It sounds like what you're saying then is in an effort to not have students fail or feel bad about their stuff, we're also not advancing them at the other end of the spectrum.
And I think yes, I am saying that. And in addition to saying that, I'm saying it's part of our deficit thinking about certain kids. Because the reason we don't want them to feel bad is because we don't have a strong belief that they are capable. If they are immigrant students or they have a different mother tongue that they're speaking, oh, they can't do that. It's the poor baby syndrome. I don't want to push you because now that's going to cause more stress and trauma for you. So that stems from really a lack of belief. I don't care how sweetly you say it. It's still a lack of belief in their intellectual capacity. And that we know is part of kind of the dominant narrative about students of color and diverse students.
Zaretta Hammond is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about culturally responsive teaching. So how do we get beyond the poor baby? How do we acknowledge cultural differences but not at the same time make special allowances? Or do we need to make special allowances?
I don't think you need to make special allowances. And the idea isn't we're trying to teach across cultural differences. And I hear this from teachers. Well, I have 30 different cultures in my classroom. And what I help them understand is you don't need to understand the customs and the particulars of 30 different customs or cultures. What you need to understand is the continuum between individualistic culture and collectivist culture. And most of our teachers, majority teachers, predominantly white, 85% of the teachers in our schools across the nation are white, predominantly female. But the reality is that population is very monocultural, meaning very individualistic. That's the cultural orientation. There's nothing wrong with that. But in order to actually have diverse students, you know, be responsive to instruction, you have to be able to bring in other ways of presenting content so it's sticky, right? What are the examples you're going to use? What are the illustrations you're going to use? As well as other ways of processing information. And it's not just, oh, those kids like to be in a group. Because it's really reductionist in terms of, oh, yeah, diverse kids, they like to be in a group. That's what collectivism means.
It's like checking the boxes and saying, okay, we did that.
Well, and not only that, it's even more insidious. It's oversimplifying how different people process information. So it's not their racial background, and I've got to mention something about Mexico or something about Africa or something about wherever, and that I can keep teaching in the same way. So if I just mention these things, but I keep teaching in the same way, then at the root of it, we're saying it's just their motivation that is the challenge, and this is going to motivate them. When what we know from cognitive neuroscience is everybody has this thing called schema. It's how we organize all the information in our head. In order to process new information, you have to find sticky examples that allow someone to say, oh, yeah, that's kind of like...
Right? It's a pattern they recognize.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But if you don't have any idea, if you don't have a bicultural lens, then you're not able to get the stickiest examples. So it doesn't mean that you have to know about their particular customs. But if you understand kind of what they're listening to as teenagers, what the collectivist practices might be, what you can bring all of those in the classroom. So when I work with teachers, we actually go in depth into unpacking that and actually helping teachers understand the design principles so that they can gather that information and do lesson design that's more robust. So the actual instruction is something that kids will chew on more robustly and the brain actually leans in to learn.
Does it get into those really small examples like we used to get, you know, Johnny has three apples and Billy shows up with four more apples, you know, those guys? I mean, would those kinds of things change?
I don't think so. I think it's those examples are fine, but those examples don't actually ask students to grapple with complex ideas. And what we know is in order to actually grow the brain, right, get students ready to take on more rigor, you have to, just like lifting weights, you have to have them rubbing complex ideas together. The problem with those sorts of examples, they're just too low level. So me just changing Johnny to Jose is not going to change the level of rigor.
So can you give us an example of a situation where you would present something that would be more culturally responsive?
I don't think it's culturally responsive is a thing, mm-hmm. right? Culturally responsive starts by the teacher actually understanding who the student is. So if you actually look at the Ready for Rigor frame, there are four core areas, right? There's teachers' awareness of individualism and collectivism, teachers' developing a learning partnership with students so the brain gets calm and ready in an intellectually safe space. Information processing, the teacher understands about cognitive mediation and the developing a community of learners. So all the students are leveraging the idea of collective wisdom in the classroom and this distributed expertise. One of the biggest misconceptions about culturally responsive teaching is it's a thing. And I can just apply it, right? Show me an example of
right.
culturally
Which is
responsive.
What I just said, yeah.
Absolutely. Because we confuse it with multicultural education. And we think if we just mention or we have kind of food festival and fabric, right, as kind of the displays, then somehow you're going to learn how those long vowels work, right? It's magical thinking in many ways. But what has happened is now a lot of educators are using these terms interchangeably, and they're not. They're very different. And it's not just, oh, here's an example, and we can apply that. Because what's responsive for one group of children is not going to be responsive for the other. So the teacher has to get to know who the students are, has to gather information on what are they watching, what are they listening to, what makes a sticky illustration, so that teacher can do more cognitive mediation. So there are design principles around it, but how those are applied are going to be specific to who are the children in front of you. Versus what I see now is it's kind of a turnkey, I just have to do these things, I don't have to change, I don't really have to know my students, and that I'm being culturally responsive, quote unquote.
I can see the point where it's not just a matter of like putting this template over a classroom and saying, here's how we did it before. How's our doing? It's got to be different for every classroom and every set of individuals in that classroom.
Absolutely. But we do know the design principles out of cognitive neuroscience and social neuroscience. If the brain is flooded with cortisol, you can't learn. Executive functions shuts down. Now, we know in collectivist cultures, there is the way in which the social interaction actually generates oxytocin. Well, oxytocin cuts the cortisol. So rather than trying to de-stress the kids, create an atmosphere that has that sense of connection and collective purpose and routines and structures, and oxytocin will naturally rise. And as it does, it cuts the cortisol.
It's the bonding hormone versus the stress hormone.
Absolutely. But the bonding hormone has an impact. So teachers don't feel like, well, now I got to de-stress the kids. No, you actually have to have instruction that is going to generate dopamine. This makes us want to do hard stuff and generates oxytocin. So this is the point. In collectivist cultures, you know, the shaman was a neuroscientist. We may not have called those chemicals, but we knew in how we set things up that that was necessary for deep learning. But we have lost some of that. We now in schools are trying to cover content versus teach children. We are now thinking about teaching to the test and raising scores. Well, here's the reality. Only the learner learns. So if you can't get the student to do a new thing, no test scores are going to go up.
Zaretta Hammett is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She teaches teachers about culturally responsive teaching. She's written a book about it. She talks all over the country and helps train people. She blogs at crtandthebrain.com. You just heard the example of the brain science she brings to this. She'll be speaking today at 4:30 at Southern Oregon University's Stevenson Union at the Rogue River Room, part of the university's campus theme, From Ignorance to Wisdom. You can join our conversation right now on the Jefferson Exchange. Your phone calls and emails are welcome at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You're setting my brain on fire here. I'm trying to figure out where to go next. Here's a big one, though, is that it's not just about knowing the students. It's the teacher has to know him or herself.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is really big about understanding their own biases before they even get into trying to figure out what is the needs of the rest of the room.
Well, and I think that's a really important piece because I don't ever lead with implicit bias. There's a way in which over the last 25, 30 years in education, we've had a lot of focus on equity through the lens of looking at implicit bias, right? Courageous conversation, making sure you're checking your biases, addressing microaggressions. Yes, all of those are necessary, but it's not the starting point. We have to think about how do we improve instruction so all students are learning, but particularly those that have been marginalized. Now, as part of that, you have to ask the question, who do I need to be to provide that? Now, you may also need to think about what are your own biases? Where might you have deficit assumptions about who those children are? And you have to do that inside-out work, as we call it. But here's one thing that I think is really important for majority educators, mostly white educators, to understand, that just because you have an anti-racist, progressive view is not the same as having a bicultural lens. One is what you say no to, implicit bias, anti-racist, but the other is what you say yes to. So just saying no to something doesn't automatically mean you know now how to be bicultural. You know the sticky examples, you know. So there is still learning. So, keeping with the theme going from ignorance to wisdom, how will you move yourself to the wisdom of developing a bicultural lens? And that's just not what the majority of white educators have experienced doing, have been led in their professional learning communities to do. Instead, we focused almost exclusively to our detriment on the anti-racist implicit bias. And hear me, everyone. I'm not saying those aren't necessary, but I'm saying they're insufficient by themselves. You also have to be developing a bicultural lens.
And what kinds of practices would lead to that? This is not something you can go to an in-service day seminar
It for. Is not. There will be no PD on this. Most people of color navigate the world by learning and observing and taking an inquiry stance to learning how the other lives. So we learn what does it mean to live in an individualistic society. Even though it goes against our collectivist upbringing, we learn to have that dual understanding. Oh, that's how we do. You know, the saying goes, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So you learn that by moving through those spaces, taking notes, reflecting on it. Most white individuals don't have the opportunity, don't make the opportunity, don't use their leisure time to learn about the cultures of other people. And I don't mean, you know, culture as in I'm going to go on a vacation or a tour, but to understand kind of how do those values play out in terms of the everyday interactions with people.
Does this have to be done face-to-face in community?
I think it has to be done just with exposing yourself. You know, pick up Latina magazine. Get a subscription to it so that you're immersing yourself so you start to say, oh, that's what happened. Oh, that's why they're doing that. Get together with some other group of folks. There's a way in which white progressive educators really kind of get a buzz talking about the anti-racist stuff, but don't necessarily go to actually build their bicultural lens, because it's a little scary if that's not what you've done. And I don't see white educators talking to each other. Instead, we've kind of started to believe this is a cross-racial conversation that has to happen, when I really believe that white educators talking with other white educators can be more helpful in building that bicultural lens. Do you need to be in other spaces and places? Yes.
Back with more with Rosaretta Hammond and culturally responsive teaching here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. As we head to the break, I want to remind you it's our fund drive, 888-552-6191, to make a pledge of support by phone or pledge online at ijpr.org. Thanks. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are learning a lot today about learning for teachers, actually, about how to be culturally responsive educators. Zaretta Hammond travels the country and writes about culturally responsive teaching. She can be found online at crtandthebrain.com. She's also written a book called Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain. You can join the conversation here on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's talk about, we were just talking about understanding other cultures. You know, you suggested things like, you know, pick up Latina magazine, get a subscription to it, you know, understand some of the cultural references that are made. And I can hear this because there are times when they fall flat. Somebody says, hey, how about such and such? And the person they're talking to has no idea what the cultural framework is. And I imagine for a young person in particular, that would feel like, oh, I guess I'm not heard here.
Yeah, I think some of that is really necessary. So again, seeing yourself reflected, right? And I think more people are aware of wanting to bring in more diverse perspectives into the curriculum, wanting to diversify the content and the literature and the books. But there is a way in which we want to do that that's uplifting, not kind of the heroes and holidays, because, again, that's just kind of the surface. If I just kind of put these up there, you'll respond to them.
Go way beyond Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez, for example.
Absolutely. And not just who we're talking about, but the idea that we're rubbing complex ideas together. This isn't, I just need to show you who these people are out there, but to engage the idea. So as we're reading, you know, history, you know, Howard Zinn talks about whose perspective has been left out. What's the other perspective of this historical event? You know, same thing when we're starting to talk about math and science, because there's a way in which people think, oh, we can't do it in math and science because, you know, that's not culture, that's just math. It's just procedural, it's kind of just neutral. But the reality, it's not the math itself, but it's how you help students learn the math. Can we do that more cooperatively? Can we leverage talking, right? Vygotsky talks about we process by talking. Collectivist cultures, that's a key feature. Where are students having math talks? Where are they actually being able to do that? I had one teacher, she took that to heart, and she leveraged a couple of things that I thought were really powerful in students making mistakes in their math computations. She would pick a wrong answer, and she had established what Ron Rickard calls social cognitive norms, that errors or information is one of those cognitive norms, right? Not confirmation of low intelligence. So it became kind of a badge of honor to actually have your wrong answer picked. And what she would do is she'd pull up an easel. She'd write out on big chart paper the wrong answer, all, you know, step by step, all the computations. And kids would pull their chairs up in a semicircle, and they'd start to do a postmortem on this this problem. What went right about it? Where did it go wrong? What do you think was being, you know, the thinking behind making that move and that choice? So now what she was doing is she was elevating this to an instructional conversation. They were doing higher order thinking about this math problem. They were using the collectivist practice of distributed expertise. The misconception that people have is culturally responsive teaching is only about mentioning things about race or culture or ethnicity, when it's really about using these principles of collectivist practice so that now the student's brain, which is used to learning in this way, is being leveraged.
That's really interesting because I have many questions. I could spend probably the entire hour and another one talking about failure and how to deal with the fear of it. But in this case, the teacher is the one failing on purpose and asking the students to do the correction together.
Well, she's actually leveraging the natural mistakes they're making. Mm-hmm. So she's not necessarily making this, you know, problem up. This is, she collects them and actually says, I saw in your homework this problem. Let's actually now dissect it. Mm-hmm. So she's leveraging, she's created a routine around regularly talking in this way in math, but it is culturally grounded in the idea of distributed expertise. We're smarter together, but it's also the talking. It's not just, oh, let's go have kids work in groups.
Right.
It's the, even individually, I'm doing my thinking, but I get to listen to you do your processing as she's guiding and facilitating them.
Can I guess that you are in favor of heterogeneous groupings in school where you've got all kinds of different people in classroom rather than like put all the smart kids together? Because I've heard about in heterogeneous groupings that a group working together, everybody gets boosted.
Well, here's the problem. You have to be looking at any of these practices through an equity lens, knowing that schools are places of social reproduction and the reproduction that our public schools want to reproduce is racial stratification. So now you have to be looking at how I'm grouping kids. What are the status issues that are going to get played out? What are the equity issues that might be there? There's a whole body of work. There are a whole lot of folks that have actually been doing that work. But here's the thing that we know from research. Kids working together need to have time individually to process their information. So one of the things that I really support teachers to do is, you know, have 5 to 10 minute breaks in which kids are just processing information. They're able to process that by themselves. Have them, give them an opportunity to go and get with a group, right? A trio to like, I'm struggling with this problem. Oh, how would you? So they're getting help, but they get to go back and do their individual work. There's a way in which either it's homogeneous grouping or heterogeneous. There are a lot of other configurations in the in-between that actually will support students to be able to carry more of that cognitive load by themselves.
You opened my eyes in the book with a section on the deficit thinking paradigm. Can you lay that out for us?
Yeah, the idea that we have dominant narratives that are at play and that people are socialized into, particularly Robin DiAngelo talks about this idea of living in kind of a racial bubble. If you don't have interactions with other folks of color or other communities, then you are more apt to be accepting certain narratives about who they are, that they're prone to criminality, they're maybe lazy. Dr. Daryl Sue lays these out. He says there are 9 of them. And the idea is if you don't really understand that these are dominant narratives, then you can't break free of them. So we hear this in school as teachers who say, those kids. That's a tattletale sign, right? Because they're automatically othered. And there are other ways in which we language it. researcher out there, Micah Pollack, has a wonderful book called School Talking. And this is exactly what she lifts up, the way we talk about kids and to kids that reinforce a deficit view of them. We can't help them be better learners if we don't believe that they're intellectually capable of that. And some of the narratives about First Nation students, English learners, African American students were, are, they just don't have the intellectual goods. White students are smarter. We hear teachers saying this, the things we hear in schools. That's why she's written several books, because we would be appalled at that, but it happens every day. And there are ways in which we hear it and we just kind of shine it on. But every time we do that, we allow that deficit view, kind of like a virus, to take hold. Schools have to learn how to create, and particularly school leaders and teacher leaders, counter narratives. So the idea isn't, oh, we just need more implicit bias training, because that's what you're saying no to. But you don't have anything you're saying yes to. The counter narrative is what you're saying yes to. And that is, our students are geniuses. This is evidence of that genius, that the genius of African American students to persevere and to be creative. Just look at street culture, how much it's influencing Madison Avenue.
Truly.
Right? The minute we say, oh,
yeah,
they can't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, why are you stealing their stuff then? Fashion, music. Why is that happening? Because the dominant narrative would have you believe you're not capable of it. That's how we maintain racial stratification. The school that has embraced equity, embrace being more responsive to students, has to be able to have these counter narratives. I like to use the analogy of a hospital. Hospital doesn't try to keep a virus out. It's coming in on the bottom of your shoes. It's coming on your hands. What it tries to do is to make its environment inhospitable to this negative virus. We have to make schools inhospitable to deficit thinking, negative views, and microaggressions against kids. Environments, classrooms, schools have to be intellectually safe spaces to do the kind of grappling, struggling we need in order to move from ignorance, I don't know how to do this, to, I can do this. Students need that intellectually safe space to do that grappling. But if we don't do that, this is Carol Dweck's work around fixed and growth mindset. And just telling a kid to go get a growth mindset, like you can go get it at CVS on aisle 3A, it's not going to do it. And this is what we hear a lot.
Is culturally responsive teaching, is it a major part of the curriculum at teacher training programs now?
It is not.
Why
I think
not?
Do we have another hour? Right?
No, we have about another minute.
I know. Well, it should be. And we have to think more around instructional equity. We need to make sure teachers are building their bicultural lens.
Wow. So you're still working very hard at this, I see.
Absolutely.
All right. It is culturally responsive teaching. We're talking about Zaretta Hammond's book is Culturally Responsive Teaching and the Brain, Promoting Authentic Engagement and Rigor for Culturally and Linguistically Diverse Students. That came out 4 years ago. Zaretta Hammond is on campus at Southern Oregon University today, speaking at 4:30 at the Stevenson Union Rogue River Room, part of the university's campus theme for the academic year, From Ignorance to Wisdom. And, well, you opened my eyes for sure today. Zaretta Hammond, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.